Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Now we do see at least some planting progress in 7 of the 18 reporting states, but only one of those is a Midwestern state. That is Missouri, 1% of the corn planted versus the 5-year average of 4%.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
The other states reporting at least some corn planting progress: Kansas, Kentucky, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Texas. Texas, of course, leads those reporting states, 63% planted, 5-year average is 58%. But the state with the best planting progress during the week was North Carolina, a big advance from 3 to 17%. That's ahead of the 5-year average of 15%.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
USDA ending stocks number were basically unchanged, and that ending stock number sort of aggregates everything together for us ag economists. And with an unchanged number, wasn't too much excitement there. We did have an above average trade estimate for international exports.
Guy Allen is the senior economist at the IGP Institute.
Interesting thing on corn, last week we saw China come in, and on Monday they bought 1.08 million metric tons of corn, which was a bit of a surprise and a good robust number for a single day's flash sale reports. 640,000 tons of that was old crop, current season, and then 400 and some was new crop for next year. Then with corn again this Monday, they came in for a similar type amount in a flash sale. Another big amount with a similar distribution, over 600,000 tons for old crop and about 400,000 tons for new crop. So, look, that's really gave some support to the markets. We continually have talked about China and their importing fairly high-priced corn. And, again, reflect back to our conversations, we sort of got to really question the USDA's carryout numbers for China corn specifically. And, again, I'd sort of suggest that I don't think all that corn's there. But not surprising, when we get to talk about wheat is becoming increasingly tight, and it's got to stay priced out of the corn ration, and we can't afford to feed wheat. So I think a lot of that big China corn purchases is in the wake of higher wheat and just wanting to secure that food supply. The USDA did drop those imports by 3 million metric tons, but that was before the second big round of purchases, and I think the market's sort of discounting that a bit, and that's why we're looking at that pretty hard. Look, the U.S. is pretty much the big supplier of corn. They're going to have to come to us for that. We're the cheapest corn in the world market at the moment. We are keeping a close eye on the Brazilian situation as that crop develops, particularly that second Safrina crop develops. We're keeping a close eye on that, and then when that harvest will commence, and that'll be a big impact on corn.
Talks about revisions to China.
USDA brought China's import numbers down 3 million tons to 91 million metric tons. That's compared to just a hair under 100 million tons last year. Last year's imports came in at 99.8. Now, that drop, I guess we were sort of expecting that a bit. I think it could go a little bit lower. I don't think it'll drop below 90 million metric tons. But I think it's reflective of a couple things, but predominantly poor crush margins and poor domestic demand. I just don't think the hog numbers are there, and I think the higher prices for soybeans maybe have that livestock feeder in China ratcheting back the level of soybean meal that they are putting in their rations there. That said, I think the USDA was a bit more optimistic next year's soybean imports, expecting a recovery in that livestock sector, and expect next year's imports maybe to rally to an 11-year high on that. So we'll sort of see how that goes.
And the increasing COVID closures in China.
It's always a concern of demand when people get locked up at home, as we saw here in the U.S., their dietary consumption changes and actually drops off a bit. I think that's a driver of that shifting demand curve to lower levels. The other thing it's a bit of a concern is in the transportation and freight. That port at Shanghai particularly, as well as other ports, are shipping less goods out, most of that being dry goods out. Shanghai port says they're still operating 24/7, but we're starting to see a lineup of vessels there as ships aren't getting loaded as fast as we would like. That's impacting that container supply chain. And we've seen prices come off a little bit last week for containers, but they're still at very, very historically high levels.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Back in the huge price spike back in 2008, 2009, we had 26 companies operating 42 facilities. Well, we dropped significantly. We dropped down to 15 companies only operating 26, even 24, all the way down to 22 facilities before prices started to fully drop again in the natural gas market.
That's Peyton Harper with the Fertilizer Institute on how we got here.
The natural gas market stabilized, continued to drop price a little bit, and so you saw the amount of companies, a couple came back online, but you see more and more production facilities come back to where we've been holding steady, anywhere from kind of that 31 to 35 facilities in the U.S. That are producing ammonia. But the real thing to look at here is what our capacity for production is. So in the U.S., you know, when there was 42 operations in play, that was our highest capacity that we've had in the past 20 years. We followed the dip as far as what the price of natural gas was concerned, but today, even though we only have 35 as compared to 42 companies operating, we're just below the same level of capacity. We're getting more efficient. The industry is getting better at making the products and being able to put out, if needed, as much capacity as what we were able to see back in 99. So very, very similar capacity levels here, which is a great thing to keep in our back of our mind when we look at some of the trade factors and supply and demand that are coming into play.
He addresses Russia's impact on global supply.
For the past several years, Russia has been a major fertilizer producer. However, on more on a global level compared to a U.S. import side. So for reference, ammonia imports from Russia to the U.S. anywhere from about 4 to 7% historically. You know, of course, that's changed recently. Global imports of global imports of potash, however, anywhere from about 4 to 7% still in play here. We're going to talk a little bit about Belarus in a second as far as what the U.S. is concerned. However, from the U.S. perception on potash, 84% of all of our potash is from North America. It's from Canada. We import that from the Canadian border. But Russia's impact is really on the rest of the world. So the world marketplace really, really relies on Russian potash, Russian nitrogen, and other Russian products as compared to what we do in the U.S. But that still affects the price of all those products across the entire supply chain.
And what's the impact of Belarus?
Belarus, second largest producer of potash in the world, right after Canada. So when we look at Belarusian potash, when you add that in with Russian potash, that was about 11% total from what the U.S. was typically historically importing. Of course, that's changed today. Luckily, like I said, the majority of ours is coming out of Canada. So from a supply perspective, we're still in a very good position on potash supply and import and export in the U.S.
But all eyes still remain focused on China.
China's really the kind of the oddball on this one. So starting back in October, China had a ban on all phosphate and some nitrogen products leaving the country. That ban extends into June of this year. So we're still waiting for signals to see whether or not they're going to lift that ban in June, if it will have an extension on it. But what I bring this up to say is that has a huge impact, especially as the number one producer of nitrogen products in the world on the world marketplace. A complete ban on certain products has really had an impact on the overall global factors from being able to purchase fertilizer and fertilizer price indexing.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What the Ag committees have to do with the Farm Bill or any legislation they want to approve, they have to work off what the Congressional Budget Office calls their budget baseline. So essentially that's their score or cost for what the current legislation is going to cost moving forward. So in this case, the 2018 Farm Bill, every year CBO says that we think it's going, the current policies, if they're extended for the next 10 years, are going to cost this much money with no changes.
Reese Langley is Vice President of Washington Operations for the National Cotton Council.
And so then the committee, when they start to look at writing a new farm bill, they're going to look at, say, the ARC PLC program, and if they want to adjust the reference prices by, say, 5% for each commodity, then CBO will come back and say, well, that's expected to cost, you know, X billion dollars to do that. And like you said, you may say, well, why is that the case? Because prices for every commodity are so much above their reference prices. But the way CBO looks at it, and again, they're taking a 10-year view of this, and there's what they're using, what they call probabilistic scoring, which means regardless of where market prices are today or where they think they're going to be 5 years from now, they're still going to assign some percentage that something's going to happen and cause commodity prices to decline and start triggering payments. So that's why there's almost always going to be a cost associated with increasing safety net or support levels regardless of where market prices are.
And what about crop insurance in the 2023 Farm Bill?
In terms of the overall crop insurance program, I think certainly we've seen in the last few Farm Bills, there has been an effort to come in and try to put limitations or restrictions on premium subsidies and other things that would be very problematic. Fortunately, all those efforts have been defeated. And I think we'll probably face some of those same challenges in the next Farm Bill debate. But I feel like in recent years, the groups that represent the crop insurance companies, the agents, as well as the commodity groups and Farm Bureau have all worked very well in a strong coalition to defend crop insurance. And I think that'll be the outcome in the next Farm Bill. And then secondly, I think kind of back to Steve's question about can there be things done to adjust the safety net, you know, are there things that can be done within crop insurance to try to make it even more effective, better cover some of those gaps that we have today? Obviously, the recent history of having to have an ad hoc disaster program almost every year now for about 7 years. We know there's some in Congress that want to look at maybe putting in place a standing or permanent disaster program. But again, where do you get those resources and what does that look like? And is that the best approach or should it be more resources in crop insurance to, again, fill more of that gap and maybe eliminate that need for ad hoc assistance when you have those major disasters?
Tim Lust is CEO for the National Sorghum Producers and has a warning.
One that I worry about is the threat side that you brought up. There's a lot of things being done right now tying back into crop insurance, and I'll just, you know, use cover crops as an example. Some of these are being done legislatively. Some of these are being done administratively. We have to remember, ultimately, we have to keep that program actuarial sound. What has allowed us to have crop insurance is it goes back to being actuarially sound. And I think we have to be very careful about what we do over the next 5 or 10 years that starts messing with actuarial soundness.
Tim Lust with the National Sorghum Producers. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A year ago, 2 years ago, let's go 2 years ago, I remember I spoke at this meeting in March of 20, and COVID was just kind of like coming around. It wasn't quite a thing yet. And I remember in my meeting, somebody sneezed. And we kind of joked around like, wow, don't sit by that guy. Well, that's exactly what ends up being kind of reality, right? I think that's the guy that started it, by the way. So, but like a week or two later, COVID was like the world. It just took over, okay? And so all of a sudden, we're just shut down for 2 years.
Dave Fogle is with Advanced Trading, speaking recently at Commodity Classic on avoiding blind spots.
Nobody saw it coming, and nobody knew the impact to the business. Nobody understood ethanol plants can shut down, feedlots can shut down. There's just so much to it. And now it's over. I don't know why it's over. We all have theories, but it's over. Okay? It can come back, right? It can come back, and now we can go right back through this whole crazy thing, and it became this really political thing, which I hate, but it became really political. So then, all of a sudden, you've got this thing in South America. Every year, you guys have chance of droughts anywhere, but this was a big one. No one talked about, no one saw it coming. In my career, in North America, in my career, droughts that affected the market were 83, 88, 2012. Now, I know you guys have had some local stuff in your backyard, but those are the only 3 years we really had significant Corn Belt droughts that really made a difference. So what is that, 37 going on 38 years? Something, 39 years? In 39 years, three different times the crop burnt up. How many times do you guys use weather not to make a decision? A lot, right? And here's how it works. It's never your backyard. I get guys from Ohio telling me how bad it is in Iowa. And that's why the market's got to go up. And then I get the guys in Iowa asking me, how bad is this crop in Ohio? I hear it's really bad. Neither guy's been to either state. But they just read something on the internet that said it's bad somewhere else. You got to really stop using the weather to justify not selling something or not marketing something. It's just, it doesn't work. Three times in 39 years. And if and when you guys do burn it up with crop insurance and with the tools that I'm going to talk about here in a few minutes, it's okay. If you guys sell bushels, there are ways to stop the price from going up and just really hurting your operation. Okay? So if you sell bushels and use the tools and you burn it up, you'll be okay. You got crop insurance. But if you just sell bushels and don't use the tools, now you got a problem. Because now you're going to get a good crop insurance payment and you have to make a decision. Is that going to pay for my crop I didn't raise? Or is it going to pay for the lousy sale I made? I can't do both. But if you make a sale and use the tools I'm going to talk about and have crop insurance, which I think 95% of you guys do, it's okay. We're good. But you can't sell. When I first came out, crop insurance back in whatever year it was, I remember going to meetings with crop insurance people who I didn't really know, and they were pushing you guys to sell your APH. You can't go wrong. And I don't know what year that would have been, but a year later, the market rallied a lot. And then they go to more meetings, and the crop insurance guys are like, whatever you do, don't sell. You got crop insurance. You got to put. It can't be both. You can't be one or the other. If you want to sell, sell. But there's tools to make sure you're okay on price and production.
That's Dave Fogel with Advanced Trading. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When we start to look at fertilizer prices, and this is a historical reference, so from January 2007 to March 25th of this year. So one of the things I'll point out, you see the huge spike here. Most of you in the room probably remember 2008, 2009 fertilizer prices. Historical highs, from what we know.
Peyton Harper is with the Fertilizer Institute.
We followed along over the past little bit, and then we hit 2016. From 2016 until the very beginning of 2021, we were really buying fertilizer at 10-year historical lows from what we had seen from the 2008-2009 spike. So we get used to something when we start purchasing over and over again. Well, then all of a sudden, the past year hits, and you all know about the spike on this. But one of the big factors is when we start to think about the amount of traded commodities in the world. When we say commodity, we probably immediately go to crops. Well, commodity crops, hugely traded piece in the world, but fertilizer almost is over double the amount of traded product. So when we look at metric tons of fertilizer that are traded as compared to metric tons of crops overall, fertilizer is traded at over a 2-to-1 ratio for that. It is a highly fluid commodity that's moving hands almost daily. One barge can trade hands 10, 12, 13 times before it actually gets to marketplace where you're able to purchase it and get it onto the farm.
But as challenging as the fertilizer situation is, there's still optimism. Sam Sparks is a producer from Mercedes, Texas.
I'm really excited about the future of agriculture. I think, with everything going on in our country right now, We're just now starting to see people recognizing the fact of our food is important, our food quality is important, the availability of our food is very important. And so I think you're going to see farmers recognized in a different manner moving forward. We're going to be held in hopefully a higher regard, and people maybe show us a little bit more respect for what we do day in and day out, to make sure that food is on their table.
But why are there misconceptions among the public?
Yeah, I think the general public misses out on what's going out in the fields from a production standpoint, mainly because farmers make up less than 2% of the population. So we're essentially a needle in a haystack. So when it comes to sharing our voice or speaking our voice, we just don't have the opportunity to do so.
He talks about the importance of stepping up to speak on behalf of the industry.
It's tough. You know, I've been asked by several different organizations to get involved, and when you're asked, you feel obligated. It's your opportunity to share your voice and your voice of your neighbors and your friends. And, you know, we as farmers, we may be producers, you know, in different parts of the nation, but we're collectively working together for the same goal. And so you feel obligated to take part in those organizations and represent agriculture as a whole.
If you're not involved, then why not? Sparks challenges.
I would say you need to step out of your comfort zone. This is not my comfort zone as well, and you just need to see it as an opportunity to be a voice for agriculture. And you know, for anyone to think that they're not qualified, you are. If you are sowing seed in the soil and producing a crop, you're definitely qualified.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As we look ahead, as far as any real work on developing the new farm bills, we know that's probably not going to happen until early next year. So we've got to get through the midterm elections. So as far as the question of the likelihood of being able to adjust reference prices or other support levels, you know, I think there are several factors that come into play that we've got to watch and wait and see how those come out.
Reese Langley is Vice President of Washington Operations with the National Cotton Council.
Obviously, one, again, is going to be the outcome of the elections, who's in control next year, who is the leadership of the agriculture committees in the House and Senate, and then also, what are the conditions in the ag economy at the time? Are we still looking at these elevated input prices? Are commodity prices still where they are? Or how have those adjusted, say, a year from now? Because I really think it'll be about this time next year when the hard work will start being done by the committees in trying to write the new farm bill. But the biggest challenge, as we all know, is just the fact that, you know, we're probably looking at having to write a farm bill with a level budget baseline, so not any new money to be added. And if that's the case, then what can the committees do to try to find some savings maybe within the existing farm bill to be able to adjust those support levels? And again, all that, the cost of doing that is a function of where commodity prices are at the time and where they're projected to be over the coming years. So a lot of variables there. But I think if I had to say today, it's going to be very difficult for the committees to be able to do that, because I think today they're probably looking at writing a new farm bill with level funding or no new money.
Now, Tim Lust is the CEO of the National Sorghum Producer, says it's important to know how legislation actually happens.
There are two parts of getting something done. There's policy and there's politics. I think often a lot at the farm level, we think about the great policy work that's done at Texas A&M and at Texas Tech, the behind-the-scenes work of an analysis, and that is truly important. But that is often not what gets a vote across the House floor. That is certainly not what stops bad amendments sometimes in the final processes. The fact is that if you want to win re-election today in the United States, you have to be on television. And to do that, you have to have resources. So candidates are going to get resources. The question is, who are they going to get those resources from? And so it is incumbent on agriculture and our organizations to be there and to use that tool to help get our message across and to help protect agriculture. I'm very proud of the work, and we talk about what is known as the Coalition of the Willing, and Sugar's not here by mistake. They have been a tremendous leader in this for all of agriculture. But certainly, you should be very proud of what's been done at PCG and the growth that has happened there and how that tool is more powerful today than it's been. We continue to invest a lot in our political action committee and continue to grow it a lot at Sorghum. And we don't use it by ourselves. We work with these three, Tom Sales in the back, a common tie with a lot of us, but we work together on these events, and we work together on this because it's not something that is a good standalone event.
Which brings up the idea of political action committees, often referred to as PACs.
You know, PACs are really that tool you use for education and relationship building. And, you know, we talked about the time constraints with members, but that's a way to get about an hour of dedicated time with that member and some of their senior staff to talk just about the issues that we care about. And that's so valuable.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Most of us have been aware that the nation's winter wheat crop is having some problems, and nothing in this past week has done anything to change that. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says as we start this week, 36% of the nation's winter wheat is rated in poor to very poor condition.
The highest amount of acreage rated very poor to poor at this time of year since all the way back in 1996.
Last year at this time, only 17% was rated poor to very poor. And Rippey says this week, this year,
we see at least one-fifth of the winter wheat rated very poor to poor in half, 9 of our 18 reporting states, led by Texas at 79% very poor to poor.
And Rippey says a storm across the north might bring some needed moisture to crops there, but in the dry southern plains, that weather system's likely to bring more dust, more wind, more stress on wheat. In other words,
things just keep getting worse.
Gary Crawford, Washington.